They were speaking, of course, not for my ears alone, but for the ears of the Pakistan government translator, interpreter who was there. They told me that they were anxious to see a settlement in Kashmir. I said, well, would you go back to fight again? They said, yes, indeed, we are going back, unless something happens. Well, the army people in Pakistan headquarters at Rawalpindi told me that they could stop a new incursion of the tribesmen if the government ordered them to stop that incursion. But everywhere in Pakistan, I felt a tremendous sensitivity, a feeling that Pakistanis were being pressed by India. In many cases, the feeling was not well held, but a feeling which I felt was tremendously dangerous in the terms that it might be the emotional foundation which would lead to a state of war. In the case of Kashmir, of course, India is a have nation. Pakistan is a have-not nation. I see no reason to think that war over Kashmir would ever start from the Indian side. It never does start from the side of the have country. War between Pakistan and India would destroy the two largest elements left in southern and eastern Asia outside of the communist orbit. Prime Minister Liaquat Ali Khan, on a radio program last Sunday, said that he thought that the American people were not concerned with the people of South Asia in spite of their protests of great interest, but that the American people were interested only in the danger of war with Russia and what they could do to counter the moves of Russia. Liaquat Ali Khan said, in effect, we don't want to be pawns of American policy or Russian policy. If you want to come in and help us solve the Kashmir problem, or if you want to help come in and help us solve our economic problems, come in because you want to help us, or because we're human beings too, not because we are pawns in the fight, the Cold War, against Russia. I think that this feeling is spread through Pakistan and also through India. In Pakistan and in India, of course, this is a period of tremendous social change. On a bright and quite cold Christmas day, I went in a jeep up over the Banihal Pass into the Valley of Kashmir, the center of the disputed territory. A day or so later, after having talked with civil people and military people about how they felt about Kashmir, and having gone into bazaars and shops and talked with people to see how the ordinary people were feeling, I went out to a village where I'd lived for a matter of 3 months in 1940, some 10 years ago. That was the time when France was falling. Nobody in the village had ever heard of any danger to France. I wouldn't be overstating the case very much if I said that practically nobody in the village had ever heard of France. It was the war, to their minds, in which our king was fighting the German king. Our king, of course, for them being the British king. And it didn't make much difference whether our king won or the German king won, because our king was keeping them poor, and if the German king came, he probably would make them poor. As an interesting sidelight of that time, before we got into the Cold War situation, they said they didn't want the Russian king to come. That was the thing they were worried about. And I said, why? He said, well, the Russian king wouldn't let us worship in our mosques. Well, I went back to that village this winter, 10 years later, and I was very warmly greeted, got talking with people, let them raise questions, and they said, that's a very critical situation in Xinjiang, isn't it? I said, yes, indeed it is. Quite startled that they'd ever heard of Xinjiang. Well, it turned out that a number of the Chinese nationalist officials who had had to leave Xinjiang when the communists took over had come over the mountains and into Kashmir and down their valley near their place, so that they knew about Xinjiang, and they knew that the communists had overrun Xinjiang. Then they said, with China having gone communist, that's going to be very difficult for India, for us, for Pakistan, for the whole area, isn't it? And I said, yes. And they went on to talk about Burma. Well, there were three school teachers in the village, earning what I suppose would not be regarded as unusually good salaries for school teachers. One of them was getting $5 a month, and the other $3.50 a month. They explained to me that during these war years and the post-war difficulties over Kashmir, great tides and eddies of impact from the outside world had passed through this village. that people in the village had become aware of things that they had never dreamt of before, never heard of. Now, they don't know what's going to happen as a result of this new knowledge, as a result of these new contacts, but obviously social ferment is very, very strong throughout that area, and I think I would be safe to generalize and say that in India and Pakistan, down in the plains, it's very much the same way. We're dealing with a different people, different kinds of village attitudes than we were 10 years ago. We're dealing with social ferment that is even more important and bigger than the political changes that have occurred. Economically, India is very hard-pressed. Partition took away its main wheat belt, much of its long staple cotton area, most of its jute. As a result, India has fallen into a very curious economic situation for an agrarian country. Formerly, it exported raw materials and imported manufactured goods. That seemed normal. Now it is having to import raw materials and food for its largest industries, the textile industries, cotton and jute. And in order to pay for those imports, it's having to export manufactured textiles and other goods. Whether an agricultural country like India can export finished goods in order to import raw materials in the way that a little, highly industrialized country like the United Kingdom can do is something that remains to be seen. Politically, India looks also with some apprehension at the near future. The Congress Party, which led the fight for independence, is subject now to division, uncertainty. One of the great problems in the near future will be the question of how to get the leadership transferred from the present generation, which is aging, to a new young generation, which has not yet thrown up the visible leaders to take over responsibilities. India is in a difficult, critical situation, fighting its way through. I was impressed with the fact that even though there's a good deal of disillusionment in Delhi, a great many officers and a great many others too, still proud of their independence, still working very hard for a future which will be better than the present in which they're living, are going at it at a pace that I would hardly have expected from them. They're pushing very vigorously indeed. But India, like these other countries, is so preoccupied with its internal problems that it is not looking outward nearly as much as it was even 2 years ago. The fence philosophy is active in India, and of course that reinforces the position of Prime Minister Nehru, that the world need not be divided into an American bloc and a Russian bloc. He's restated that this last week, of course, in response to the Hoover suggestion that the United Nations be separated. Here we have in South Asia, therefore, a part of the world which is in tremendous social ferment, where political change has come very rapidly indeed, where independence, political independence, is the new facade as against former colonial rule, but where independence is obviously not enough to establish and maintain stability and to increase productivity for the whole area. How do we go into that? What happens? What should the United States do? I can assure you that there are, to my knowledge, no magic paragraphs to give the answer to that question, no 100 words which can explain away all of the difficulties that exist. I was very much impressed with the fact that with political weakness in the area, it would not be possible to go in at a political level seeking the support of governments for the American cause before the governments have stability and the support of the people in their own country. Economically, I think there is a great deal to be done. I think that in some terms, the United States can help in doing the job that exists there. I don't believe that billions of dollars should be poured into that area. The type of agrarian economy disturbed and upset without industrial leadership, without craftsmen in the modern techniques, can't absorb big amounts of money. It must go in very slowly and very carefully. I foresee nothing if we are going to help at all in that area, but a tremendously difficult series of small-scale aid projects in which here and there we can help local people to establish themselves a little more firmly than they are established today. And if we do that, and do it for for their benefit and for the benefit of increasing areas of stability and security in the world, then I think we can concern ourselves with our direct moves in the Cold War on a somewhat different basis. If one thing was repeated to me again and again on this trip that I've just completed through South Asia, it was that the peoples of South Asia are interested very much in their own problems and are not so much concerned in the Cold War. That, I think, is the dilemma that confronts the United States in that area of the world today. And that is what we have to deal with, recognizing that in these weak countries, with communist pressure growing stronger from the north, we have indeed reached the 11th hour in South Asia. Thank you very much.